It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Abby Hornacek.
I'm Ben Domenech.
I'm Dana Perino, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, December 2nd, 2022. I'm Chris Foster. Democrats rally around a new leader in the House. Some conservative Republicans are divided about Kevin McCarthy becoming House Speaker in January.
They think he's not responsive to their agenda, to their concerns. They want a seat at the table, and they're continually, you know, publicly, there are microphones and cameras all over Capitol Hill, and they continue to find them and say, he doesn't have our votes to become Speaker.
We're speaking with Fox News Sunday host Shannon Bream.
And Lisa Brady, mentally ill and homeless, a potentially dangerous combination that New York is hoping to address. But could the new plan test legal limits?
I think there is generally an acceptance of the idea that some people with untreated serious mental illness are going to need some sort of involuntary treatment.
And I'm Tom Shalhoub. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
California Congressman Kevin McCarthy has been a member of the House Republican leadership since 2009, the leader since 2019, with an eye on becoming House Speaker when Republicans take control in January. He needs 218 votes and a full House vote, and it's expected to be a fight.
All the work that we want to do, from rolling out the investigations, from rebuilding our economy, from securing our border, none of that can go forward without us moving forward on the floor, having the vote of the Speaker, putting the rules in, and working together as one.
Leader McCarthy on Fox. On the other side of the aisle, New York Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, with no challenge in the end, is the Democrats' new House leader.
It's an honor to stand before you today as the incoming House Democratic leader for the 118th Congress.
He has the job held by Nancy Pelosi for 20 years.
Folks on the right will say he's extreme. He's so far partisan, so far left. But you've got the progressives where he's really pushed back against the squad in the past. Now they're having conversations about how they can work together.
Shannon Bream's the host of Fox News Sunday.
But the progressives have been worried that he wouldn't be open to their position. So we know that he's had meetings with folks like Congresswoman Jayapal and that they're, you know, trying to find ways that they can work together. But he's done some pushback of the progressives. He's helped some of the Democrats who were being challenged, some of the incumbents, by some of these progressive up and comers trying to come into their primaries. So, you know, like any leader of the party, he's going to have to manage all of those different factions. But it sounds like he's having conversations with them. And people think he's got a lot of strong leadership qualities and will be able to step in this role and just hit the ground running.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years that job has been taken by Nancy Pelosi, and now suddenly Jeffries, by all appearances now, was just sort of anointed. But we also know that behind the scenes, it's been, you know, whatever, a year, 2 years, 3 years, that this has been bubbling up, where he's been building a coalition of people. And and the Democrats number two and three now are Catherine Clark of Massachusetts, Pete Aguilar of California, and they've just sort of quietly banded together to rise to these positions and become a new youngish generation.
Yeah, and we always chuckle that when we're talking about youngish, we mean people like in their 50s, which makes me feel good that that's, but that's Capitol Hill when you've got leaders who are in their 80s, 50s is youngish. And there's been pressure, as we've talked about many times, within the Democrat Party to have that next bench of leadership, to give them a chance to step up to the plate and get things done and usher in the new generation of leaders. So, you know, Congressman Jeffries was very much had the, as you say, kind of the anointing, had the stamp, the seal of approval from those outgoing leaders, from Speaker Pelosi, from Steny Hoyer, and from James Clyburn, who was fighting to stay in leadership as one of the older members of that generation. So he's got a lot of people who are on his side. And as you said, it takes a lot of behind the scenes work of building those coalitions and getting members on your side and proving to them that you're going to be the leader who can move them forward. And he's been very skillful at that. So he's got the stamp of the old guard and now clearly has a seal of approval from the next generation as well.
Yeah. So he'll be the minority leader. He'd like to be House Speaker in 2024. We'll see how that shakes out. The Republicans on the other side of the aisle, their leader, Kevin McCarthy, he would like to be Speaker of the House in January. He had this aborted attempt at becoming Speaker in 2015 that kind of fell apart. And now he's dealing with some opposition now. What's going on? Why isn't he 100% being rallied around?
Yeah, and I think it's the same issue that Hakeem Jeffries has got with the Progressive Caucus. Kevin McCarthy's got it with the House Freedom Caucus, the folks that are further to the right over in the House, more conservative. They think he's not responsive to their agenda, to their concerns. They want a seat at the table, and they're continually, you know, publicly, there are microphones and cameras all over Capitol Hill, and they continue to find them and say, he doesn't have our votes to become speaker. And this gets really tricky because then you've got some factions out there saying like, well, maybe we'll just go with the moderate choice or go with someone that we can get some Democrat votes to pull us together. McCarthy's made very clear he will not lobby for and he does not want Democrats' votes. He wants all the Republicans voting for him. But Congressman Andy Biggs, who is one of the more conservative members, says he thinks there are a significant number. I think he said 20 that he thinks are not going to vote for Kevin McCarthy. That would be a problem for him, given how close this margin is going to be for Republicans. So he's doing the same thing that you see Congressman Jeffries doing. He's over there having conversations, trying to reassure these people and bring this coalition together. But he's got some really conservative members who say they will not vote for him under any scenario. And that could be a problem.
Well, that was my question. Is this just a protest, hold his feet to the fire vote? And in the end, they will vote for McCarthy as speaker? Because I don't know how the machinations work. If he cannot get those 218, what happens?
Yeah, they continue to go to additional votes and ballots until they get some kind of consensus. So listen, as much as they've publicly said, we're not going to vote for him, I don't know how he changes their minds because they're going to have to pivot or he's going to have to pivot. So whether they then get into the nitty gritty and realize, you know, it's better to get half a loaf of bread than no bread. I think it was President Reagan who kind of gave that analogy. So they're going to have some tough decisions to make. And I got to think it's in their interest to go with someone who will at least listen to what they have to say versus a candidate who's going to shut them out completely. And, you know, Chad Pergram, who is our excellent resident expert on everything on Capitol Hill, has told us about scenarios in which votes went on for days and weeks until the speaker situation was settled. So who knows if we're about to go down that path again?
Yeah. Looking ahead to early 2024, there's a Democratic National Committee meeting happening that could shake up the primary calendar. It's been Iowa and New Hampshire for seemingly the beginning of time, and some people think it's time to move on from those states as being too white, too old. Maybe let's start with someplace like Nevada, maybe Minnesota or someplace else. It would be really strange to not start with Iowa and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And think about all the Iowa t-shirts we've all gotten over the years. You go there and then people know you're going to descend there for the caucuses. I mean, this is, if you're a wonky political nerd, as I will call myself, you can classify as you like, but we like this stuff, the inside stuff. This to me is fascinating because then you have threats that, okay, by some leaders, if the Republican and Democrat caucuses aren't on the same weekend in Iowa, then we're going to move our caucuses to, you know, Halloween to the October before that. So, the threats that are getting thrown around are interesting. But remember what Iowa, you know, this is just before COVID really blew up and we kind of came off the political trail. What happened in Iowa was so strange. The caucus was never really settled for Democrats about what happened there and who actually won. Still questions about how that whole vote went down. So Iowa did not make a good case for itself with Democrats in 2020. It'll be very interesting to me to see. And I think the president has got a lot of sway over what happens here. And if he makes any pronouncements on how this thing goes down, I think he's going to have a lot of power to help set this calendar. And of course, he's going to want to do that in the way that's most advantageous for him and for his party in case he doesn't run. But gosh, I love this inside baseball stuff with these parties fighting internally and with each other about who gets to go first in the nation. It will be a big change if Iowa's not number one.
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of diner owners in Iowa that are going to miss out on some revenue that they count on every 4 years.
Exactly.
Yeah. Georgia Senate runoffs in a few days. There's been strong early voting. Herschel Walker, the Republicans, had to deal with questions about, you know, maybe paying for abortions and questions about, does he really live in Texas? His supporters, I assume, just like how he's fighting through these headwinds. But some Republicans might just not show up rather than vote for him or the Democrat, Raphael Warnock.
Yes. And what a nightmare Georgia has been for Republicans. When you think about these, you know, Senate seats, the two that were up after the 2020 election and how that whole thing went down, and now they're off in this runoff again. And I think if the Senate was hanging in the balance, you know, if this is a situation where Republicans had a chance to flip the Senate, I think there'd be a lot more energy, obviously, behind Herschel Walker. But given that we know Senate Democrats are going to control the chamber by virtue of having the vice president as their tie-breaking vote, I think there's a lot less excitement and heat generated on the GOP side of the ticket.
Yeah, I was shocked to hear from Georgia's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan. He's a Republican. He says he waited in line to vote in this runoff, and he got there, and he looked at the ballot and said, never mind, and walked out and just didn't vote.
Right. And you got to think, you know, for him to even say that publicly, kind of disastrous for Republicans. But listen, the governor, Kemp, who had a sizable, easy victory over Stacey Abrams, is out there campaigning with Herschel Walker. A lot of people think Kemp being on the ticket and the love for him and his popularity actually pulled Herschel Walker up far enough to get into this runoff. Whether it's going to be enough here, like I said, I think if the Senate hanging in the balance was still an issue, it would be much better for Herschel Walker. But I just think that there's going to be a lack of enthusiasm on the GOP side of the ticket. And there, you know, in Georgia, there is weariness. This has gone on and been so ugly for months. I do think a lot of people are sort of checked out. They're on to Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and the joyful holiday season. They're done with politics.
Yeah. Vice President Pence, you're going to talk to him on Sunday, right?
We are. And I found some fascinating things in his new book. And he's very detailed about what went down on January 6th and leading up to that, all of the disagreements he had with the president about whether or not he had the power to do anything on the floor when he was overseeing the counting of the electoral votes. And gosh, there is some real, you know, he broke with the president and there was some, I don't know if we want to call it bad blood, but definite tension and issues there about the conversations he was having privately with the president, trying to tell him his hands were tied and he had a ceremonial constitutional duty to go there to vet the objections to these. But ultimately, he had no power over changing the electoral count vote or refusing to accept those votes, even getting so bad as to the point as the night before there was a New York Times piece that came out that said that Pence had said to Trump, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. And there was a piece, that New York Times piece, that the Trump campaign responded to and said it's fake news. Pence and the president are on the same page. Pence knew that was a lie. And at that point was so furious. He just walked into January 6th knowing what he had to do and what he was going to do. And the inside scoop about what went down with the Secret Service and everything that happened that day is really fascinating. But you know, he's getting tons of criticism. Yes, he acted admirably that day, even as critics will say, but they're saying that he enabled the president for 4 years up to that point so that it was this ugly, bad day for the country. So I'll ask him about that criticism. And he's got some interesting inside stories on the Supreme Court, too. And since that's my beat, I was really interested by those nuggets. And we'll talk about that
as well. Very good. Finishing up, soccer. You've been watching. I know you're a very busy person. You've been, but it's cool if the games are on during the day. You've been, you know, trying to sneak a little bit in here and there. You a fan?
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say I am married to a diehard soccer fan, so he keeps me up to date. I thought World Cup was like, okay, maybe a game or two over Thanksgiving. I didn't know it was like four games a day. I don't even know if you're supposed to call them games, matches. I don't know. But for days. So yes, we are all in this household. Team USA, go win on Saturday.
Shannon Bream, host of Fox News Sunday. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
You too.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
This is Tom Shalhoub with your Fox News commentary. Coming up.
America's largest city launches a new plan to deal with part of the homeless population, allowing police and other city workers to hospitalize people involuntarily if they're deemed to be showing signs of mental illness and posing a risk to themselves, even if they're not posing a risk of harm to others.
For too long, there's been a gray area where policy, law, and accountability have not been clear. And this has allowed people in need to slip through the cracks.
Mayor Eric Adams says the city will still do all it can to persuade those in need of help to accept services voluntarily.
But we will not abandon them. If those efforts cannot overcome the person's unawareness of their own illness.
He says they'll also push for change at the state level, but this is partly an effort to use existing law. The mayor says it's a myth that someone has to be violent, suicidal, or presenting a risk of imminent harm for involuntary assistance to be given. And the new policy confirms that posing a risk of harm through an inability to meet basic needs is part of the standard for mental health interventions. But Adams is facing strong pushback. The Coalition for the Homeless says he continues to get it wrong, that he relies on ineffective strategies and scapegoats homeless people and others with mental illness as violent. The group also says he's ignoring issues with voluntary access to psychiatric care. And the New York Civil Liberties Union is already suggesting the plan may violate constitutional limits.
Well, Mayor Adams thinks that he has the legal authority already to implement this plan to a degree.
Stephen Ide is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Homelessness in America.
That is to direct frontline providers, police, that they can start abiding by this new standard for civil commitment. But he's also pushing for a number of legal changes at the state law. The state government is a huge player in mental health. So ultimately, the success of this plan does depend a lot on Albany.
There's a lot in play here in terms of if police encounter a homeless person, you know, they first have to decide, does this person pose a threat to themselves? There's some enhanced training involved. There's even a hotline they could call to sort of get advice on this during an encounter. But it seems pretty subjective. I mean, is the nature of the decision-making progress something that could ultimately cause a problem?
Well, I think there is generally an acceptance of the idea that some people with untreated serious mental illness are going to need some sort of involuntary treatment, meaning probably involuntary hospitalization in some cases. We used to do a lot of that decades past. We began doing less and less over the years in hopes that we were building a better public mental health care system, but that cohort never went away. And so what he's saying is that that cohort is actually larger than we're giving it credit for. More people need involuntary treatment than are getting it now. So we need to look for a way to expand access to hospitalization. And to do that, we need to examine the legal standard that determines when we intervene with somebody when they say, no, 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 I don't want any services. Because sometimes we know that we really can help someone, even if they insist that they want to remain right there on the street.
Mm-hmm. The jury's kind of still out, though, right, on whether involuntary hospitalization is helpful to someone in the short term or especially in the long term, because at some point they're either hospitalized, they could argue, for too long, or they're maybe let go too soon.
Well, I would say one way to begin thinking about that is, what are the alternatives? Well, the likely alternatives are, first of all, just leaving someone there in the street in squalor. And we know that people who are homeless suffer all kinds of bad things. They die a few decades earlier than the average American. They're abused, they're victimized, all kinds of terrible things happen to them. A very likely outcome is they wind up in jail. As we reduce the number of people in mental hospitals over the decade, it looks like the number of people in jail who have a serious mental illness swell. There are now about 1,000 people in the New York City jail system who have a serious mental illness. That's much larger than any sum in any state mental hospital left in New York. So if we are trying to clear a bar that's set by jails or the streets or shelters, I don't think that's an impossibly high bar to clear. And ultimately, that's what the mayor's trying to move towards.
You've written the book, literally, on homelessness in America recently. This is obviously a problem, especially in other big cities as well. Do you envision this plan as something that would translate in some of those other cities, something that they might try as well, getting more aggressive with the mentally ill homeless population?
Well, in principle, yes. Every city, to a degree, grapples with this problem defined by the intersection of homelessness and mental illness. There's the mental illness problem, there's a homelessness problem, and they intersect, and lying at the intersection is this cohort that the mayor's trying to do something about. Certainly, if you've ever been to San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood or Los Angeles, you know that this problem is not unique to New York. And it's an exhausting problem. It's a depressing problem. And despite enormous resources that have been devoted to it, particularly in New York and California, a lot of people are sort of inclined to throw up their hands. It just seems like we can get nowhere with it. So, yeah, if New York City can get somewhere with it, that would, I think, be very encouraging to jurisdictions elsewhere, such as San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Mayor Adams in New York has faced some significant
pushback for this plan, some of it coming from the New York Civil Liberties Union, their executive director saying he's playing fast and loose with legal rights and not dedicating the resources necessary to address the mental health crises. I guess the flip side of that would be at least he's trying. I mean, do you think that level of criticism is warranted at this point?
I think that the mayor knew he was picking a fight with this. I think that he just thought that the status quo is unacceptable, that, you know, we've been doing a lot of the things that those advocacy groups want for a long time. And New York will continue to do that. But we really need to reassess our attitude towards involuntary treatment. This is going to require a sustained push, certainly throughout next legislative session in Albany. And the mayor's going to need a lot of support, and hopefully he's going to attract more support. But I think, you know, a lot of people in the public are going to be sympathetic to this because this is just, you know, New Yorkers, like, why should this be such a normal experience in New York to just walk by somebody obviously suffering and just sort of shrug your shoulders saying, well, you know, I guess he's supposed to be there. Like, what do you want me to do? What else could we expect? So he's trying to do something about that.
The mayor's plan includes enhanced police training and emphasizes a team approach for handling someone in crisis. There's also a hotline for police to call for help with decisions about involuntary transport to a hospital.
Police right now, they don't have a direct path to what they have to do in normal policing. So now you're taking them for the homeless situation.
Joe Cardinale is a retired New York City police lieutenant who says this will put police in a more difficult situation.
We've faced this before. We've had homeless issues before. Mayor Giuliani approached it and did the same thing. This is a page out of his book. If they don't want to go, take them by force if you have to, because it's for their good. All right. But if we look at what's happening on the streets of New York right now with the homeless people and with other people that aren't homeless that are just shooting up on the streets, they're just living there, they're attacking people, they're doing things, they have become a major detriment to this city. So we should have the right to go in and take them into protective care, not custody, protective care. Get them the physical help they need, the mental help they need, get them the food they need, the nutrition, give them a warm bed to sleep in. Some of them are so adverse to this, they don't want to know anything about these programs. They just want to be out on the street. But what happens when they find these people, you know, dead on the side of an avenue and people are walking by them and you don't know whether they're sleeping or anything? You need to get them the help.
I guess the concern, too, with, as you say, some of the people not really wanting help, per se, the concern is always, well, does this mean they could be end up institutionalized, you know, forever, trying to transition back into some sort of a quote unquote normal life becomes a factor?
You know, you have to feel for many of these people that are out there. Many of them are veterans. All right. So the veterans have to, you know, the VA has to get involved in this as well. These individuals have families. Some of them don't. Many of them do. Many of their families don't know where they are. So if you can identify who they are and where they've been and what their intentions are and try to put them in touch with their family, if you get one success story out of 10, out of 20, it's good. So any program to get back to where we were to help them and get them off the streets is a good program. It's just that you have to fine-tune it without government overstepping their bounds. You want to fine-tune it where the police are comfortable doing their job, saying, hey, I could work with that. I could do that. We had emergency psychological training back in the day, and it continues to this day. So the police department does evolve with what's happening in our city today. But it's become a dangerous situation because so many of these homeless individuals are attacking people on the streets. And that, I never saw that to the degree it is now. You saw it occasionally, but not to the degree it is now.
Is there a better solution to address these, I guess, really dual issues of homelessness and the portion of the homeless population that commits crime and that does have mental illness, a better solution than what the mayor is rolling out?
The mayor should know about this because he's on both ends of the spectrum. He was a police officer, he was, you know, a supervisor, and now he's the mayor. What he needs to do is bring the people that know mental health the best into a conference with the police department, sit down and say, how can we make this work? And just get a forum together and say, what do you think? But this is what I fear. You cannot ram it down the police officer's throat. This is what you have to do. They already took the judgment away from police officers when it comes to policing on the street. Now you're going to tell them this is the way this has to be done, and it goes against some of their training. What I'm saying is it has to coincide with the training they already have and add to that training. But when you stop putting mandates on the police officers, you will do this, you will not do this, then they're just going to sit by and say, hey, you know what they're doing now? There's no more proactive policing. And this comes under proactive policing.
I wondered if this is a responsibility police and their leadership would want or not want, or is it a situation where they do want the chance to do more?
Oh, I think the police department would step up to the challenge of doing something about this, absolutely, because it affects our city. It affects crime. It affects definitely the quality of life in the city is greatly affected by this. So you need to have them come up with a plan where everybody's on board and it's an effective plan. You know, many of them aren't criminals. A majority aren't criminals. They're just, like I said, some of our veterans. So we really need to help them out no matter what. And mental illness has been put by the wayside for way too long. For the past 3 years, it's been put on the back burner. And this is the residual effect from that. So people need to step up to the plate and get them the mental help they need and the physical help they need. They need to be taken care of because the cold weather's coming. All right. And that's another bad one.
That can be a killer, too.
Absolutely.
Former NYPD Police Lieutenant Joe Cardinale, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, anytime. Thank you for having me.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
A New York law enforcement officer is getting a reputation as the baby whisperer after delivering an infant at a home on Long Island. Suffolk County Sergeant John Eric Negron was one of a group of officers who responded to a woman who went into labor at her home recently. About 15 minutes after she'd called 911, her new baby boy made his appearance into the world. Sergeant Negron had known what to do because it was not the first time he'd been pressed into service with a home delivery. In 2017, he responded when another baby arrived unexpectedly at a Mount Sinai home. When he got there, the baby wasn't breathing, so he sucked the fluid out of the infant's airway with a turkey baster from the family's kitchen, and the boy took a breath. The child's parents asked Negron to be the baby's godfather, and he accepted. He now celebrates birthdays and holidays with the family. Negron doesn't have any kids himself, but he has also assisted in other births during his career. He told Newsday that he keeps expecting each time to be the last, but at this point, he wouldn't be surprised if it happened again. In New York, Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tom Shalhoub.
What's on your mind?
When I was a kid, during the Christmas season, one of my neighbors had white lights all over their property and their Christmas tree. Just plain white lights. I didn't understand why anybody would want boring white lights. I like the colored lights, and I like them blinking. Now, as an adult, I like white lights. I think they're very nice, very classy. But my kids, they like the colored lights. So when Christmas season comes around, we have to negotiate a little bit. A little bit of the color, a little bit of the white lights. But no blinking. That's where I draw the line. And every year, we buy a real Christmas tree. The debate is, when do we get it? Right after Thanksgiving? Or do we wait until the middle of December? Now, when I was growing up, we had a fake tree. I liked it. At the same time every year, we'd go up in the attic and we'd drag the tree box down the stairs. We'd take the fake branches and spread them all over the living room floor and we'd organize them by size. And then we'd start to build the tree to the sounds of the Andy Williams Christmas record. So, real tree or fake tree, which do you like? These are the kind of debates that can tear families apart. And when do you open your presents, Christmas Eve or Christmas morning? Well, the folks at Fox Nation thought we better settle these debates once and for all. So we put together what I think is the most fun Christmas special ever, the Great Christmas Debate. We brought together some of the great Fox News personalities, Janice Dean, Jerry Willis, Julie Banderas, Will Kane, Jimmy Failla, and Micah Loftus. We had two teams in front of a live audience tackling the toughest questions of the holidays. It's streaming now on Fox Nation, and I hope you join us. And remember, it's not about who wins or loses. It's about who brings the most spirit. I'm Tom Shalhoub.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network, Fox News Rewind Financial Crisis 08. A look back at the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression.
The market is not functioning properly.
Subscribe now at foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.